Thank you, Rob. It's a great pleasure to be here and privilege to be here with Regina and Linda. I'm really honored. My name is Vinny DeMarco, and it's been my pleasure and honor over the last 20 years to work on public health issues of reducing teen smoking and underage drinking and gun violence and expanding health care, and I've really, really enjoyed it. I'm president of the Maryland Citizens Health Initiative and national coordinator of Faith United Against Tobacco, and I agree completely with what Rob said earlier, that the vast majority of, I know, Marylanders and I believe Americans strongly support the public health and health care measures that we're all about, that are part of the federal health law and that are things we work on all the time. But I have also come across those who are in the minority, but the loud and vociferous minority. And I remember my community organization in Northeast Baltimore City, I came to them to get their support for reducing gun violence, and they did support it, and we got it done. Then I went to them to increase cigarette tax, reduce teen smoking. I'll never forget this really big guy at the front of the audience got up and said, "Aren't you the guy who came after my guns? Now you're trying to take away my cigarettes. Next thing I know, you're coming after my ham." And I assured him we're going to leave his ham alone. I didn't tell him I was a vegetarian because he probably would have shot me. But, you know, we overruled him, and the community group endorsed our proposal, and we got it done. But that gentleman represents the loud and vociferous minority who look at us as public health Nazis and the nanny state. But, you know, the vast majority of people strongly support what we're doing, but sometimes we have a problem, many times we have a problem, because there are large vested interests with a lot of money who have a stake in the status quo, who make money off cigarette sales, even to kids, and guns being sold a lot, et cetera, and alcohol. So how do we overcome these powerful vested interest oppositions? And that's what the book is about that Rob mentioned earlier, which I can brazenly urge you to buy since I don't make any money off it. And Mike Perchik, the author, and I are going to be here at APHA tomorrow at 2:30, so come on by at the Public Mart and you can pick one up. And what the book does is describes what I like to think about as a six-step process to expand public health and overcome these strong, powerful opponents. And the first step is to really work hard to come up with a smart public health plan, like increasing the cigarette tax or reducing gun sales, et cetera, that really saves lives. And you know how to do that, and you come up with a smart plan. Number two is to do some good polling to really test public support for the proposal. And number three is to build a powerful coalition. I like to say to advocates, for a while, do what you don't want to do is ignore the legislators for a while, ignore the policymakers, and build a powerful coalition. Get a lot of the faith community behind you, really build a powerful coalition. Number four is use the media. I like to call the media a giant telephone to reach out to the public and educate them about what you're talking about, why your proposals make sense, and why the public is behind it. Use earned media, use the paid media. Fifth is to make the issue a big issue in the elections. Make candidates stand on it, and voters will choose candidates who support our position. And sixth, of course, is to advocate for it in your legislature. And these are all described in great detail, and I think very well written in this book by Mike Perchik. But what I want to talk to you more about today is, what do you do when a bill is passed? Like our federal health care reform, which President Obama got passed, is wonderful. But how do you implement it? How do you get it done? And I'd like to urge you to think about three things to do when you pass a major public health measure. The first I like to call a brag and thank. Make sure you go out there and hold press conferences, do media, buy media if you can, to let the public know this great law passed and to thank the legislators who did it. When we passed our major healthcare expansion in Maryland in 2007, we bought a front page ad in the Baltimore Sun congratulating Governor Martin O'Malley of Maryland for getting it done, and the Maryland General Assembly for getting that done, and a major increase in the cigarette tax, which helped to fund it. And we held press conferences all across the state to celebrate it. And also celebrate when you get the data showing that your law works. Recently, we held a press conference in Maryland announcing that over the last 12 years, smoking has dropped by 32% in Maryland, 32%, which is double the national average of 16%. Who here is from Maryland? I just want to thank you for being Marylanders. Maryland has made a tremendous progress, and this is translated into 70,000 lives saved from terrible tobacco caused death and illness. A tremendous public health success. So we held a press conference to brag about it, and the Washington Post actually ran an editorial talking about how this happened, and the editorial was called The Great Smoking Divide, comparing Maryland and Virginia. Anybody here from Virginia? Talking about how in Virginia they didn't do this, and their smoking did not drop as much. So we got a lot of publicity on all of these efforts to brag about how Maryland has done well. Brag and thank. I don't know, a lot of advocates somehow think that they don't need to or shouldn't for some reason thank legislators and governors and mayors who get their legislation passed. I completely disagree. They're humans. They like a pat on the back. They like to be told they did a great job. Now, sometimes it's true. You have to spank them. You have to let the public know they did something wrong. But when they do something right, make sure you're out there thanking them and letting them know they did it right, and you're going to let the public know. In Maryland, we were very proud of the fact that our healthcare law that passed in 2007 was bipartisan, something that did not happen in Congress. In Maryland, Democrats and Republicans voted for our law, which expanded healthcare to over 200,000 uninsured parents, children, and helped seniors also. And that law was something which we wanted to let the public know Democrats and Republicans supported. How did we do that? We held press conferences from one end of the state to the other to let people know about it, to let people know that the legislators and the governor got this law done. And in far western Maryland, in Garrett County, which is very Republican, they have a Republican delegate there, Wendell Beitzel, a great guy, conservative, but he voted for that law, and he came to our press conference, and we thanked him, and we also invited to that law a woman named Crystal Moon. Ms. Moon is a woman who was uninsured for many years. Her husband worked full-time, but they couldn't afford health care, and she was bringing up her kids and going to school. They couldn't afford health care, but she knew about the children's health plan, so she went to her local health department and said, I know you have this program for children. I can't get health insurance. Can you insure my children? They said, sure, but also, Ms. Moon, there's this new law signed by Governor O'Malley, which also expands health care to you. So why don't you sign up? And she hadn't known about it. She did sign up. A couple weeks later, she was feeling very ill. Had she still been uninsured, she would have tried to sleep it off, as many uninsured people do. Instead, she had this new card. She went to her doctor, and the doctor said, Miss Moon, thank goodness you came here, because if you hadn't, this would have killed you. So she came to our press conference and said to Republican delegate Wendell Beitzel and all of us these words, thank you for saving my life. And that was highlighted in the local paper. And that's the kind of publicity you want. And then what we did was we took all these stories and put it together in a book we call Faces of Maryland's Newly Insured. I know we, like others, like to publicize and highlight people who are uninsured, people who are suffering, but when people benefit from your public health expansions, highlight it. And this book, which was not easy to do, but it took us months to do, we have a great social worker on our staff who did it, has 40 stories in it, including Ms. Moon's, which has their story of how the new law helped them, maybe saved their life, maybe helped them survive a major illness, et cetera. And it talks about how we all benefit. As you know, when the uninsured go to the hospital, run up huge bills, we all have to pay for that coverage. And this talks about how we're all benefited. So really brag and thank as much as you possibly can. Second is do everything you can to fully implement the law. A lot of advocates made the mistake of passing the law, maybe doing a thank you and bragging, and then say, okay, on to something else. No, no, no. Make sure the law you passed is working. Get heavily involved in the regulations and the implementation. And this is especially true with the federal Affordable Care Act, because it is kind of complicated, and we need to make sure it's implemented right. Our governor, Martin O'Malley, who, by the way, was overwhelmingly reelected this past Tuesday against an opponent who opposed health care. So in Maryland, we're going in the right direction. And he has created a coordinating council, which is working hard to fully implement the law, and we're actively involved with it. So if you're from Maryland, go to healthreform.maryland.gov and get involved. You can also go to our website, healthcareforall.com, and see all of this. But get involved in the implementation. Make sure the regs are done right. Make sure the state is doing the right thing and implementing the law. That's number two. Number three, and this is very, very important. Don't make the mistake of thinking that everybody out there knows as much about it as you do. You know, we're doing this all the time, and we're thrilled that the healthcare law passed, that our law passed in 2007, but many, many of the people who would benefit from it don't know about it. They don't read the paper as much, or if they do, it just goes over their head, or they look at the TV. They're very, very busy. It's quite understandable. So they don't know about it. When our law passed, dramatically expanding Medicaid coverage in Maryland in 2007, the state estimated that 25,000 people would enroll. We knew that the universe is around 65 or 70,000. We didn't want only 25,000 people enroll. How are we going to do, how are we going to make the people know about it? We decided to create a major outreach program. And this is going to be very important at the federal level, too, when 2014 comes and the major Medicaid expansion. You know, the numbers that you hear about the new federal law will provide health care to 30 million people, that's based on an assumption, like our state based, that many people won't sign up. That's why there's this new organization I'm proud to be part of called Enroll America that Families USA is helping to put together, which is working to do some of the same things we did in Maryland nationally to make sure everybody who's eligible gets enrolled. So it could be 40 to 50 million people if we let everybody know about it. So what did we do in Maryland? We went out to some foundations, some of them who were kind of leery of advocacy, but not leery of this, not leery of really educating people. We asked for grants to put together a program that involved billboards, that involve getting the message out through community organizations, hiring some outreach people, and very importantly, using the media. Using media to get out the message. And we decided to run radio ads, which I'm going to play for you in a minute, but let me talk about why we did this. There are people out there who we're not going to reach in any other way except through the media. People who listen to radio and need a message, a clear message. Now, we didn't want it to be boring. We wanted it to be interesting. So we reached out and got the Governor O'Malley, and we reached out to and got prominent football players, Ed Reed from the Baltimore Ravens and Chris Samuels from the Washington Redskins, people know about. And number three, we wanted to make sure that it's useful, so if you hear the ad, you can act on it. And if you have an ad with a long 800 number, it's just going to be ignored. But we worked and we got to use 311 and 211. So you hear the ad, wow, I could get health care. All I have to remember is 211. When I go home, I call. And there was a dramatic increase in the people signing up for health care in Maryland. And I knew the ads were working because when the ad with Governor O'Malley and Ed Reed from the Ravens, and by the way, when I asked the Ravens for a player, I'm a football agnostic, which is very unpopular in my household, and they said, what about Ed Reed? And I asked my teenage son, and he said, Dad, he's great. He's one of the most popular football players in the country. I said, well, I guess we'll use him. So a lot of people knew about it and were excited, and the media loved it, so we had press conferences, great articles, and TV coverage of it. But I knew it was working. And the day the radio ad was running, I was in a parking garage in Baltimore City, and I heard these attendants saying to each other, you heard Ed Reed talking about healthcare today? That was pretty good. So I knew we were making some mileage. So because of that coverage, the number of people insured went from 25,000 estimated to over 65,000, and we helped a lot of people like Crystal Mood. So I just want to close by playing these two radio ads and urging you to do the same kind of thing in your state. So if Regina can help me. Just a second one.
Hi, I'm Chris Sandler. I'm just the second one. Washington Redskins. And I'm Maryland Governor.
Hi, I'm Governor Martin O'Malley.
And I'm Ann Reed, safety for the Ravens.
Last year, we passed a new law that expands the state medical assistance program to make a lot more people eligible for health care coverage, including doctor's visits, medical procedures, and prescription drugs.
That's smooth, Governor.
There are now 100,000 people in our state who can now, for the first time, obtain health insurance coverage just by signing up.
That's tight, Governor.
And there's a special number for citizens in Baltimore City. Just call 311 to find out if you and your family are eligible.
That's cool, Governor.
You mean that's good, right?
I mean, that's great. All of you who don't have health insurance, just call 311.
That's what I'm talking about.
This is a public service message from Baltimore Healthcare Access and Healthcare for All. Non-city residents call BHCA at 410-649-0500.
And the AARP.
Okay, and AARP. That's great. Thank you. Okay. I know it's 3 o'clock, but I'd love to have, you know, good time for questions, and unless someone comes to kick us out of the room, I'll just stay. You know, I'm sure our panelists are willing to stay, and get questions. I just want to say that on the clinical preventive services side, it just to emphasize the last thing that Vinny said, is that it's wonderful to say that there are no, there's now no cost barriers to getting all U.S. High-value clinical preventive services, but that's not going to get us from whatever the utilization is right now to 90% or full utilization. So we've really got to work on the regs. We've got to work on ensuring that we get the outreach programs going, because there's and make sure we organize our clinical provider clinical system to deliver that both in the community and in the clinic. So that's it for me. But questions, please. If you just come up to the microphone, if you have a question for anybody, we'll just let us know who you'd like to answer, and we'll get them up.
Hi, my name is Kay Randolph Back. I'm a health policy consultant from Michigan with 10 years of experience from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation. I wouldn't be surprised if there's some former grantees in the room.
I'm one.
And my question is really for Dr. Rosenstock. And it's trying to relate what we're hearing about social and economic determinants of health with workforce development. And what I've seen over the years, Kellogg, which you probably know, has been extremely active in workforce development, is that people kind of glide over the issue of the disproportionate racial and ethnic composition of the workforce. They may focus on, say, generalists versus specialists if you're looking on the medical care side. And I've tried to work with one of our presumably prestigious medical schools in Michigan about raising awareness on this, and you get a blank, even though there's the Sullivan Commission report and so on. So I'm wondering what the strategies might be to break through the barriers.
Well, I agree with your observation, first of all, and I for some of you who are reading more than listening to my slides, there's actually a couple of times that diversity gets raised. So I think we have opportunities with the healthcare reform legislation. We have opportunities to fund differently, to analyze differently, to get a greater workforce. With those opportunities comes the opportunities to be more attentive to diversity and pay attention. I know a lot of us have been in situations, unless you get a chance to hire people, you can't fix your current lack of diversity. You need to do a lot of other things to make it happen. I think the issue about multiple determinants of health, I will take it at two levels. One is we want a diverse workforce because that's a good way to improve the public's health in and of itself. But the interprofessional education, I think, is a very key piece to this puzzle, because it really changes people's perspective on what people are bringing to the table from different backgrounds, professionally and otherwise. So I'm feeling hopeful. I think this may be one of the few things we can salvage from all of this. You're hearing a lot about this. There is a lot of money that's appropriated that would be very hard to take away, even in a nasty era. A lot of the opportunities, like this loan repayment program, that's a good way to get, let's say, people want to go into public health but don't want a high debt burden, who might be attracted to higher paying jobs outside of governmental agencies, to come do good work. If that though has to be appropriate, and that's going to be competing against other things, and that's where we're going to need to do a lot of advocacy. Yeah, well, that's an easy one, right? That's a complicated big issue, but again, I am a Pollyannic even with Tuesday. But so what do we have? We've got at different levels. We've got community transformation grants. I don't want to forget those. We started off this session with those. Those are opportunities to do some different things in the community, empowering some folks in the community to think about health, and I agree with demanding health in a different way. We have these debates going on within professions. They really are very serious, and the question is, how do you optimize those? And I think if you get, I believe in getting people sitting together, interprofessional associations working together. We've done some of that, the AAMC with ASPH, with APHA, with ASTO, and the like. I still feel that if you get people of truly thinking of themselves as teams with a little bit of threat against the common status quo, there may be some shifting ground, because it's very hard to move a professional guild by itself. That's the downside, right?
Great. You know,
they elected him.
They elected me. You know, I will tell you that I would not want to answer that question, only because I'm afraid I might answer it incorrectly. It's really my area is prevention, and you know, the insurance aspects of the law are not not sufficiently tuned in to be able to respond to that. So, what happened to the gentleman who asked the question? He already left the room and discussed, or oh, he's sitting right there. Okay, sorry about that. But I can, you know, but I, you know, I'm sure that there are people that can answer, that can answer that question, who are much more tuned into the, you know, to the insurance aspects of the law, and who's obligated to pay what, which is really what you're asking about. Well, I think that I will just tell you from an advocate's position that the people, there will be certain people who will have to have a stick, because they'll be paying, they will be tax paying, and they will have to either sign up for the mandated coverage, or suffer a penalty for not doing so. So it from an I will tell you, without even knowing the specifics of the law, that the advocacy side of this would not be sufficient to respond to what the critics of the law will say, that it's forcing people to buy something and therefore unconstitutional.
I agree completely that we should be advocating the ACA on a positive basis, that we all benefit.
And there are some important specific things that are taking effect right now. We held a major press conference on September 23rd highlighting that now everybody under age 26 can stay in their parents' health plan. That's very important. It's very popular. It needs to go out there. Small businesses can get tax credits from to afford health care. That's very important. We're going to do radio ads, hopefully with the governor of Maryland again, highlighting that. There are a lot of positive things we should be talking about now. And the broader positive is, again, we all benefit when everyone's insured, because when we passed our Medicaid expansion in Maryland, we did not run ads saying, let's help poor people. That is not going to win you votes and get something enacted. What we ran ads saying is, when there are people who are uninsured, we all suffer because everybody pays $1,000 per year for premium to cover the health care of the uninsured. We ran ads saying that's a hidden health care tax. Let's get rid of that hidden health care tax by expanding health care. So I agree with you positive, but completely. Those are the messages we should be getting out there.
Well, on the advocacy side, I just add to that it's already in effect that there's no payment for clinical preventive services. So that's another positive to sell. But you've got to remember that, you know, once the law goes into effect, the idea that it's going to be repealed on the basis of this argument that people are going to unfairly have to pay for something that they don't necessarily want and reduce their individual freedom, so the law needs to be repealed to remove the mandate. It's already a non-seller from the health insurance plans who says, if you do that, then you can't keep the provisions in for eliminating, throwing people off for pre-existing conditions or lifetime coverage. So to whoever's arguing this, if the Republicans are going to argue that in Congress, it's going to be a non-starter for any realistic basis. So I think there, from an advocacy standpoint, since I, you know, it, say the critics rather than the Republicans, but that's what they've said. So I do agree with Vinny that sell the positive right now, but the specific questions you have on who's covered and who's not, I think you should get a real answer to your question. Yes?
I'm Richard Biden, I'm a longtime social worker, social rehab's chair of the Public Administration Department in the Sawyer Business School at Suffolk University in Boston. So I'm a social worker, he's done weird things in my career. My question is for Linda, and I'm very aware that there's money for clinical training, but yet, like myself, as I look up to community mental health, theater principal, we do not have many money for training, management, leadership, et cetera. So my question is, you mentioned the dual possibility. What do you see as the possibilities there? A school like ours is very interested in partnering and joining with to try and move that aspect forward as well.
Okay. I think there are going to be some possibilities. It'll probably be through exactly what you've just suggested, through mechanisms of partnering. So of the first wave of funding that went out, $17 million went to schools of public health to work with community organizations, to work with our local health departments to start doing pipeline training and development training, to start collaborating across some of the professions. It's small money, but we'll need to do things like that. The dual training thing that I liked, I think it's going to work, again, across current well-supported health professional training, like physicians, like nurses, like veterinary, and the like. I don't think, much as I'd love it, that it's likely to gravitate much beyond the delivery professionals.
My name is Ben. I'm from Los Angeles. I used to be with the Federal Health Planning Program when it was in existence. I'm currently retired. Most of the conversation about the workforce has focused on two aspects, getting people into it, and then upgrading the skills of people who are already there. My question is there any effort, is there anything in the law to support the effort to improve the distribution of healthcare people and public health?
I think there's a lot, and I didn't focus that much. There's real money that is committed to the National Health Service Corps. That's certainly a distribution issue. There's real money to community, federally qualified community health centers. That's real money to attract people to distribute in a different way. I think what we haven't seen, and there's real money for primary care training, obviously, right? What I don't think we've seen is a very aggressive change in the distribution among physicians from high levels of subspecialty care, just because you're going to make it a little more attractive to primary care, isn't going to deal with that. And that's probably one of the biggest cost drivers in the system. So. And then there's Dr. Murray. I'd love to introduce the next president of the APHA. It's very exciting to have you. And an old friend. A long-term friend. We're not old, right? Very exciting to have you in the room listening to this session. I'm thinking of about 5 illegal things that I want to do. I'm going to be quiet for once.
Well, what was the reason? Was there a reason given?
I mean, this is the gumming of the works. If you don't appropriate funding, you won't enact the law. We're going to turn to you for an answer to that because you're as smart as anyone I know in this room or any about what we do. But it's a political movement we need. You're coming to be president of this esteemed organization at a wonderful time.
That's wonderful comments. Thank you. Before I leave, since I had a chance to comment on this, I think, yes, awareness, having leading organizations have a major role because they are right there, and they're right there with the ear of the audience that we need to reach right now. It doesn't stop me from saying, go back to the beginning of my comments and saying, the public is on our side. They understand, and they understand it in the broadest way possible, that community health just isn't just about improving the health of someone else who can't afford health care and now maybe can, or improving the health of the community because they feel that they have a moral obligation to help other people be healthy. They understand it, and it certainly can be reinforced for them, is that when we improve the health of the community, we improve the vitality of the community and economic vitality of the community as well. So framing the issue in terms of the interests of the broadest public, not just the publics who are being deprived of the kind of health that they deserve, is a way to bring other stakeholders to our defense when these are attacked. And so again, I think my answer to you really is that when the chips are down and it's happening right now, you have to rely on the organizations that our leadership organizations to fight really hard and gather and get the ears of those who can support us right now. So the sense of urgency. But over the longer term, we have to get that kind of grassroots campaign going that really gets the public at large to begin to weigh in. On our behalf for the change that we want and to protect the opportunities for change that in terms of developing an infrastructure to deliver it. Of course, saying the word infrastructure probably is a killer word, but you know what I'm talking about. So if that's my answer from the advocacy side. But more generally, I really appreciate your patience. We went a little over time, and people have been doing this behind your back to get us out of the room. So I'll say thank you very, very much for your kind attention, and thank you again to our great panel. Let's get out there and do some advocacy. Thank you.